should be teaching how to ask questions and even develop like a taxonomy of questions and erring away from questions that are only binary, that get us to binary sorts of answers.
Welcome to the Curious Advantage podcast, an exploration of the idea of curiosity and its increasing importance for thriving in the digital age from the authors of The Curious Advantage.
Hello, and welcome to this episode of the Curious Advantage podcast. The series is about how individuals and organizations use the power of curiosity to drive success in their lives and businesses, especially in the context of our new digital reality. It brings to life the latest understanding from neuroscience, anthropology, history, business, and behaviorism about curiosity, and makes these useful for everyone. My name is Garrick Jones. I'm one of the co-authors of the book, The Curious Advantage, and I'm here today with my co-authors, Paul Ashcroft of the Ludic Group.
Hi.
And Simon Brown, Chief Learning Officer at Novartis.
Hello.
And we're delighted to be joined by Natalie Nixon.
Hi, it's great to be here.
Thank you, Natalie. Natalie uses ideas to impact people's lives so that people can build their creative confidence, make an impact, and get paid their worth. Love it. She is a creativity strategist, a global keynote speaker, a TED speaker, and author of the award-winning The Creativity Leap, Unleash Curiosity, Improvisation, and Intuition at Work, which is what we're going to be talking about today. It's been recognized as a game-changing innovation book by Fast Company and Porchlight, and it was selected as one of SoundView's 2020 Best Business Books. Go and get that book, folks. The Creativity Leap, Unleash Curiosity, Improvisation, and Intuition at Work. Natalie is president of Figure Eight Thinking, where she advises leaders on transformation by applying wonder and rigor to amplify growth and business value. Clients have included Comcast, Citrix, Living Cities, Viner Media, and Bloomberg. A hybrid thinker, Natalie consistently applies her background in cultural anthropology and fashion. She began her career in education and as a hat designer. And later, Natalie worked in global apparel sourcing, and she was a professor for 16 years. Very well traveled. You've lived in Germany, Brazil, Portugal, Israel, and Sri Lanka. You're proficient in Portuguese and Spanish. Bom dia. Bom dia. And she's a member of the Forbes Coaches Council, a fellow of the Royal Society of Arts, and is certified as a foresight practitioner by the Institute for the Future. Okay, it's a lot. When she's not dancing up a storm in hip-hop class, Natalie is fine-tuning her foxtrot, salsa, and tango on the ballroom floor. That's a lot to deal with. I can tell you, Paul is also a mean foxtrot, salsa, tangoist, I think. But welcome to the Curious Advantage podcast, Natalie. Delighted to have you here. So, Natalie, we all have a lot in common. We've written best-selling books highlighting the benefits of being curious. What prompted you to write this book?
Well, there were two major reasons when I really reflect on it. One reason stems from my experiences of being invited into companies to consult and advise and help them to build cultures of innovation. And what I would observe quite a lot is that people throw around the I word quite a bit. Everyone wants to innovate, innovate, innovate. And I don't think we always have a clear understanding of what we mean by innovation. It just was, in a lot of ways, the buzzword. And so, just by the way, I think about innovation as invention converted into scalable value. And I think that conversion factor is creativity. Well, I wasn't always defining it as such. I just had this like creeping sensation that we were going about it wrong. And then I began to think, I think we're starting in the wrong place. I actually think in order to build cultures of innovation, we actually need to start with creativity. Now, that's all fine to say, but in a lot of hallowed corporate halls, if I were to lead with creativity, they might look at me a bit cross-eyed. And I realized that was because I don't think we really understood what creativity is, was. And that, you know, began my journey to really unpack, and hopefully an accessible and simple way, how should we be thinking about creativity? And what's the best way for me to explain why it's the engine for innovation? So a big reason why I wrote the book was to provide an accessible and simple way of thinking about creativity for a lot of organizations and leaders that were trying to innovate, and to encourage them to revamp and readjust and consider that they really need to design and creativity into their organizational culture. So that was one reason. Another reason that I wrote the book is I am a global keynote speaker. I use my speaking to really prototype ideas. And as I was fiddling and tinkering away with these concepts of creativity, why they're significant for org development and future of work, I would proffer up out ideas and concepts in my keynotes. And invariably, various people would approach me at the end of talks and they'd say, that was really interesting. Where can I read more about this? And while I blog for Inc., I realized I didn't have a central repository for my ideas. So a second big reason for writing the book was actually to productize my intellectual capital and to be able to say, here you go, read this. And that's where you can learn more about the ways I'm thinking about creativity.
In productizing that intellectual capital, so what would be some of the main messages that you cover in the book?
Well, let's start with how I define creativity. That would be a good place to start. I think about creativity as toggling between wonder and rigor to solve problems. And wonder is about awe and audacity and asking big blue sky what if questions. Wonder is also about pausing. It's really hard to wonder when you're going 80 miles an hour. So that pausing, that stillness is an important part of developing the capability of wonder. The other dimension of creativity is rigor. And this is really important because I think sometimes we just kind of stop at the wonder dimensions of creativity, which means that too often we think about creativity as this woo-woo, fluffy addendum to the, you know, important stuff. So the rigor is really important to consider as well. And rigor is about deep focus and discipline and time on task. And both are essential for creativity. And rigor is not particularly sexy. It's often very solitary. And it really matters. So that's a big foundational concept of the book. The book also, each chapter ends with practical techniques to figure out how to apply these ideas that I'm sharing for the individual as well as for the organization. I didn't stop there and just say, okay, toggle between wonder and rigor to solve problems. Off you go. Now you're creative. I realized that's kind of hard to do without getting some ideas and techniques about how do you intentionally exercise the practice of toggling between wonder and rigor. And so great that's question. Where I offer up the three I's. So the three I's are the ways that we can intentionally exercise that toggling between wonder and rigor. And those are inquiry, deep curiosity, getting better at asking questions, improvisation, which is about being adaptive and experimental. And the third I is intuition, which is a type of pattern recognition.
Natalie, I want to pick up on, you mentioned curiosity, right? And we're all about the curious advantage here. And in your book, the first subtext is unleash curiosity. And I loved how you were thinking about creativity in terms of wonder. But we know that the way we define curiosity is about having an attitude of wonder and a spirit of exploration. So there seems to be some overlap there with curiosity and creativity. I wonder what links did you find between curiosity and creativity when you were writing the book?
Curiosity, it turns out, is fundamental to creativity. In order to be creative, to toggle, do that toggle between wonder and rigor, we have to experience what, you know, Ian Leslie calls that information gap. I love the way he also defines curiosity, is that, you know, it's this product of an information gap. And so we have to be self-aware enough to know what we don't know and to be incredibly exploratory in order to want to tinker and experiment. So without curiosity, there's no beginning to creativity. You know, I'm a big fan of the work of Esther Perel, the brilliant psychoanalyst and relationships expert. I listen to her podcast all the time. And she is always dropping gems as she is doing her consults with couples. And I recall listening to one of her sessions of Where Do We Begin, that particular podcast. And she, you know, just in a flurry of brilliance, mentioned that the opposite of creativity is being reactionary. I thought, oh my gosh, that's so true. Because when we are reactionary, we actually are not granting the situation, the people around us with the gem of the question. We are only copy-pasting. We are only behaving in somewhat erratic ways. To be creative, instead of being reactive, you have to be incredibly productive. And that requires curiosity. So curiosity is a really important through line in all of the ways I think about where wonder begins. And even how do you intentionally apply rigor? It's that sometimes the rigor is much more about this internal, inward-facing curiosity, the self-reflectiveness that rigor requires.
One thing that's great about your book is that you drew on interviews with fantastic people, all from very different backgrounds and businesses and so on. Can you share some of your favorite stories?
One was a conversation with Céline Behel. She is a nose. She's a perfumier. And what I observed about the way Céline works is that she really works at the intersection of chemistry and intuition, right? She talks about having this superpower of being able to make real what no longer exists. And you think about that perfume has that ability to trigger memory, right? So to see the laboratory environment, but also to observe conversations she was having with her colleagues as they were being incredibly experimental and improvisational. During COVID, it turned out that Céline actually moved back to Grasse, France, which is her home. It also happens to be the center of the perfume world.
Yes.
Yeah, in Europe. So that was a really cool and fun conversation interview. I also interviewed our family plumber.
Nice. Do you have a lady plumber or a boy plumber?
I have a boy plumber. It would be cool to see more lady plumbers. We don't have as many in Philly. I would love to see more of them. But John Harker, he and his brother, you know, they've carried on the family business from their father. And, you know, he was a bit shocked when I asked to sit down and talk to him about a book of creativity. He was like, why do you want to talk to me? I was like, I don't know. I just wonder what I would learn from you. So we sat down at my dining room table. And at first he was a little reticent. But man, once he started to describe the ways that he problem solves, he just waxed poetic. He talked about, all I have is a flashlight. I have to be able to see what's behind the wall. He talked about how he has to interact with the carpenters, the electricians, the homeowners, the architect. And in my view, at the end of that conversation, I deemed him a systems designer. So a lot of the point and purpose of all these conversations with attorneys, with scientists, I also visited NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab and visited in Pasadena, California, and met with The Studio, which is this group of social scientists and artists and designers who collaborate to translate the research stories of the, you know, aerospace engineers. I was really, you know, a good model and a good theory is one that fits in all different sorts of contexts and situations. So part of the experiment for myself was, if this is a helpful framework, then it will make sense in the world of a perfumier and a plumber and a group of social scientists at NASA. And also, I just love collecting stories and hearing stories from people. That's the anthropologist in me. And I heard you guys mention that you also tap into anthropology in your work,
yes,
which I love.
A curious culture is a game changer. What does curiosity mean for you? Follow hashtag Curious Advantage and join the conversation.
I love the curiosity you show of going to such a diverse set of people to gain the inspiration for the book, though, as well. Also intrigued as more and more we're looking at skills and transferable skills that actually I would never have seen, you know, plumber equals systems designer, but actually some hidden skills and transferable skills.
That's right.
So, yeah.
That's right.
One of the things you just mentioned as we were talking before was that your three I's model, so inquiry, improvisation, and intuition. I think there's several models that you've developed within the book. Could you share maybe one or two more of them as well?
Frank Barrett's seven jazz principles and that heuristic yes. when I was talking about yes. improvisation.
Yeah. You've hit on Garrick's subject,
really so. Wanted to talk with you about that.
Yeah.
So maybe let's go deeper into the three I's first and then
okay.
I know there's going to be a whole bit on jazz that Garrick wants to go into. So tell us more about the three I's then. So you touched on it, inquiry, improvisation and intuition, but
yes.
Tell us more how we can use the three I's model and sort of the benefits you've seen people deriving from the three I's model.
Yes, well, the first thing to keep in mind is that it's not a linear model. In fact, visually in the book, I represent it as a Venn diagram. And I offer that by flowing in between the three I's, we actually land in better insight. That's the whole purpose of intentionally being more improvisational, more intuitive, and asking better questions. And let's start with inquiry, which is, you know, always a great place to start. Curiosity is something that, unfortunately, we get worse at the older we get, right?
I think it's 4 years old, we're at our most curious, according to some research. Yeah, yeah.
We're at our most curious. And then we enter school and formal education, and there's so many of us can recount some question shaming that we survived, right? And that's not a good thing. It's clear that if we observe our own children, if we reflect on our own childhoods, that curiosity is essential for exploration, for experimentation, and for discovery. And I'm a big fan of the work of Warren Berger, who's the author of A More Beautiful Question. And he insists, and I agree with him, that we should actually be teaching what he calls questionology. We should be teaching how to ask questions and even develop like a taxonomy of questions and erring away from questions that are only binary, that get us to binary sorts of answers. So
love that.
Getting away from binary questions, and he has a wonderful framework where he learned from his research that we should start. It's ideal to start with asking why and then diverge even further to ask what if and then begin to converge into how questions. But that why, what if, how is just a beautifully simple, elegantly simple way to think about asking questions. Because that's the other thing. It's not enough for leaders to say, okay, yeah, I welcome your questions. It has to be modeled by leaders. And also we have to start to give some tips and teach and help people. How do I even begin to ask questions? So I love Warren Berger's framework there because I think that's a really helpful way to think about asking questions. And I think about questions as inputs into a system. The system could be a marketing plan. The system could be organizational culture. The system could be, you know, a family situation, or what are we going to have for dinner? Right. Well, that is the question, but like, you know, right. Yep. So whatever the system situation is,
the family being one of the most complex,
the family is an incredibly complex system. Questions are inputs into that system.
And the better the questions, I guess, the better the inputs and the more valuable you,
And then the more dynamic the output, right?
Yeah.
So asking questions is essential for change, it's essential for evolution, and it is the beginning of all incredible creativity. Curiosity is also important in creativity because creativity is hard. Creativity requires us to fall in love with process, which often is deeply ambiguous. And there are moments when we must just accept that we have to sit with that discomfort of ambiguity. And sometimes the way out of the way we begin to pull that thread out of that dense, ambiguous clump of unknownness is through another question.
Yeah.
Improvisation is something that I really dove into while working on a PhD. And I ended up using a heuristic from jazz music from Frank Barrett to understand how we could design better experiences in services industry. Improvisation is about being adaptive, emergent, and self-organizing. Those are actually happen to be the same characteristics that we can think about for any complex system. So as it turns out, improvisation is a complex system. Jazz is a complex system. Creativity is a complex system. And then intuition is a type of pattern recognition. And well, that's at least how I define it. Sometimes I even talk about intuition as brain feelings. And intuition is not something that we touch in business school, law school, or medical school. And yet every successful leader acknowledges the role of intuition in their strategic decision making. And it's only been since the publication of The Creativity Leap that I've been getting even more fascinated with intuition, probably because of the COVID-19 pandemic. And I'm trying to learn a lot more myself about, for example, the parasympathetic nervous system. And I mentioned in the book the role of the vagus nerve in intuition, how we are hardwired to be intuitive. But I'm becoming increasingly interested in how can we design conditions in our life and work to optimize the parasympathetic nervous system and therefore to optimize intuition.
It's a fascinating topic, isn't it, around the vagus nerve? Because as you, what we've been learning, curiosity helps with this, and it helps with your vagal tone. It helps decrease stress. Presumably then, Natalie, it helps you be more open to dealing with ambiguity, which often causes stress, being more open to your own intuition.
Yes.
Could you say more about this? And the other part I'd like to ask about improvisation. As Garrett mentioned, I did a little bit of salsa dancing in my time. Probably nice. Legs are a bit more stiff than they used to be. But what I remembered is a bit like jazz. Salsa has some basic rules and basic steps. And from there, it's all about improvisation, right? And it's all about going with it.
Yeah, well, here's the thing about improvisation and creativity. It's not about doing whatever you feel like. It's about knowing the rules so you can break them. It's about knowing the boundaries so you can press up against them and then see what happens next. And yeah, you're exactly right, Paul, that in salsa and all dance techniques, there are the fundamentals and you must master them so that you can mix and match and do all sorts of mashups. The point about wonder and intuition and creativity and being able to get more comfortable with ambiguity, it all stems from being able to practice opportunities for wonder. And so, for example, one of the things that I recommend and that I actually do on a regular basis is take daydream breaks. And this is very different from meditation, right? Meditation requires a bit of intentional focus, right? That you're always constantly I'm drifting, let me, focus on the moment, right? Instead, in daydreaming, and being okay with that super relaxed state of nothingness, the prompts are things like, for me, watching a cloud drift across the sky, or an ant crawling on the pavement, or a dewdrop of water on a leaf in the early morning. And I was saying to someone else in conversation yesterday, I don't know about you guys, but do you observe that when you daydream, there is this suction that of drawing you in to this kind of time stop moment. And the sound effects I use are whoosh, right? And then there's all of a sudden you pull out of it and it's like a zoop or a zap out. And it's you feel it. I feel it at least. What's incredible to me, whether I can afford a 90-second daydream break, a 2-minute daydream break, a 5-minute or 15-minute daydream break, when I return to the work at hand, I always feel more energized. I have a renewed sense of clarity. And I suspect that's because in those daydreaming moments of nothingness, we are allowing the deeper recesses of our brains and those neural synapses to fire up, give kind of that frontal lobe a rest. And the brain needs its own sort of toggling between different regions. But yeah, I totally agree with you, Paul, that we have to be able to intentionally start exercising those moments of wonder. And I think about it on a time-space continuum. We have to give it the time and we have to make sure the space around us allows for the rest and the pausing to be comfortable, as you say, with the ambiguity.
I love the fact that our bodies, and the greatest nerve in our body, the vagus nerve, has a tone, and that we can, you know, research those tones and see where they are. And that has a sympathetic impact on not only ourselves, but everybody around us.
Yes.
And then there's so much I want to unpack with you. You've talked about improvisation. You did an amazing TED talk on how the future of work mimics jazz, which I really want to talk about because I'm a jazz musician and I get obsessed with the relationship between what I've learned from jazz and how I play and the background that I have, which allows me to play without memory, if you know what I mean, because jazz is that. But then also the frameworks that I have in place, which allows me to play socially, how I can sit down with other jazz musicians who may speak a language that I don't understand, and yet we can play jazz because we have the language of jazz in place. Let's start with jazz and the relationship with work.
So, Garrick, I love how you just said play without memory. And the reason getting comfortable with improvisation is so important is because when we are improvising, we are uniquely situated in the moment, in the present. Because if we're too far in the past, if in other words, if we're waiting for the other person to shut up so I can just go on and say what I want to say, right? I'm stuck in this past, or we're copy-pasting, that's not going to lead to any kind of inventive newness. If we're too far in the future, trying to anticipate what's next, we'll miss it, right? So the value of being improvisational is that it helps us to practice being better at actively listening, really distilling our observational skills. So I love that phrase, playing without memory. And a lot of people are intimidated by improvisation because a lot of our references to improvisation are pretty impressive, you know, jazz musicians and incredible hip hop rappers or comedic improv artists on like Saturday Night Live or Second City in Chicago. And that's intimidating.
It's exactly intimidating. But you have to learn to not be afraid, or you have to learn to not make mistakes. I saw an amazing performance by Susanne Dayin, who's this Iranian-Persian singer who sings with two voices. She can do that kind of double voice thing, which is astonishing.
Yes.
And
yes.
She had a guy with her playing CDs, you know, and he was mixing on the CDs in the background as part of the band. There were tabla players and others. And he had some glitches in his CD. So you can imagine a CD glitching. You remember that? And she totally incorporated the glitches into her singing, her improvisation, and her timing. So you can imagine the glitches from the CD, which you would have thought would have messed up the performance, she suddenly took into her performance and glitched back in dialogue with the CD. I tell you, everybody was weeping and standing up. I mean, it was unbelievable. But it's that point.
Very amazing.
Amazing. Like, not afraid and in the moment and just working with the glitch, you know.
Working with the glitch. And I love that example because she could not have done that if she was stuck about what her plan was, what she was going to do next, right? She was uniquely situated in the present. And it's so cool when neuroscientists have done their brain scan mapping of people improvising or rapping or playing jazz music live. And just like the magical colors that emerge of the brain of all of the neuroactivity that's happening. So in terms of people's fear about improvisation, here's what I always remind people of in order to assuage their fears. I remind people that you have probably hacked your way through your morning. By the time you have lunch, you've hacked your way through your day already. You've hacked something in order to support a spouse, a kid, a client, a colleague. You've done something to jerry-rig the situation in your office to get a better route to work pre-COVID. You know,
we're MacGyvering like, constantly.
Constantly. So just like, Calma, like bring it down a notch. You actually are constantly improvising and hacking your way through the day. And again, reflect on play. Like one of the reasons why we need to incorporate play into the way we work, into the culture of work, is that play A, it's fun, so that it releases all of those really positive hormones like oxytocin and serotonin, but also play, it just so happens, catalyzes all of those executive functioning skills like collaboration and active listening and anticipating what's next and negotiating and all those sorts of things. And play, in play, we know the rules of the game and we must think in the moment. Play, improvisation, these are all what we know now to be chaotic systems. And it's a word that DeHaak made up. DeHaak was the founding president of Visa, the credit card company.
Yeah.
And when he was tasked with this work of leading this global company based on the virtual exchange of currency, he wanted to design an organization that mimicked nature. And he saw that in nature, there's some chaos and some order. And when I learned about chaotic systems, when anyone learns about chaotic systems, you begin to see them everywhere. So it's the way our bodies heal. It's the way forests grow and evolve over eons. It's jazz music, right? And it's also what you observed with Suzanne Dayeen.
Yeah.
She was being incredibly chaotic.
That's right. The other thing that it reminds me of when you're talking is jazz has a structure. There's a sound of jazz, but it comes from quite a specific platform of people understanding different modalities. And that's the language. You know, Miles Davis was part of that. George Russell, part of inventing all this, the Mixolydian sort of theory of jazz. And yet when you talk about jazz as a complex dynamic system, we can extend it to beyond jazz. There was a famous group of musicians in the 1970s in England called the Scratch Orchestra, Keith Rowe and Cornelius Cardew, and groundbreakers at the time, who were sort of railing against the frameworks of classical music and everything that was going on. And they would literally pick up pipes, plumbing pipes, there's our plumbing metaphor. They pick up plumbing, they would pick up cans to bash, and they would make music with found instruments. And the music they made, at the time, people thought they were nuts. But the music, when you listen to today, the recordings, you kind of go, that's very contemporary. You know, we kind of get with it in some respect. The thing I loved about that, though, was they were listening to each other. As you were saying, they were self-organizing. The framework was emerging from the chaotic system. And I've never thought of the Scratch Orchestra as a chaotic system before.
Totally. Yeah, there's something incredibly subversive about jazz music. And if you know the history of jazz, which is America's classical music, the root of it are the spirituals, which led to the blues, which then out of the blues came jazz. And it was always, you know, music is code. It's a language. And to take the rules and then invert them and to play up in and around them was pretty cool. It was pretty amazing, no matter if you're talking about, you know, the New Orleans jazz to big band jazz to the cool period, which led to the bebop period, which then led to, you know, and Miles Davis flowed through all of them.
Absolutely.
Always learning, always curious. I always have a caveat that, you know, I've seen a couple, I really admire him as a musician. I would not want to have to be around him as a person. He had a lot of issues.
Sure.
But brilliant as a musician. And, you know, his ability to produce it and let it go and move on.
And being ahead of the game, partly
because he was okay with surrounding himself with younger musicians. Mm. John Coltrane, you know, it's just amazing his ability to always be open to learning. Curiosity is what drove him all the way up through, you know, his time working with Michael Jackson. It's just incredible.
So I'm conscious we're nearly at our time. So are there any questions maybe, Natalie, you'd like to ask of us?
What's something most surprising that you all learned in writing The Curious Advantage?
For me, that one is probably the story that we heard from the CEO of the music studio, Abbey Road Music Studio in London, where she was sharing an example around creativity that was from one of the bands there, where their demonstration of curiosity was going off and getting chicken bones from a butcher around the corner to be able to play the drums with to get a sound. And it was like something that seemed completely crazy, but it actually got them the sound that they need. And we're bringing that back into sort of a corporate environment of how do you take something completely crazy that seems like it won't make any sense, but actually it got them what they needed. And maybe that's how we use curiosity to innovate in a corporate setting.
Oh, I love that story. That's awesome. I have another question. What's one thing you wish people understood about curiosity that you think they miss?
Who wants to take that one?
Curiosity is something that you can practice and you can adopt in your life and get better at it. It's not something to think, I used to be curious and now I can't be. It is in some ways a skill that we can learn. It's like a muscle that you can work and you can get stronger and use it to your advantage.
Fantastic conversation, Natalie. So, I mean, we've covered such a lot, from defining creativity as the toggle between wonder and rigor to solve problems, how we have to pause because you can't wonder at 80 mile an hour. We learned about the three I's: inquiry, improvisation, intuition, the importance of taking time to daydream,
The daydream break,
exactly. I think we all need to go and have a daydream break at some point today. And then the links with jazz, which has been fascinating. So from all of that, is there one thing that maybe our listeners should take away? If you had to sum that up with one thing, what would that be?
Oh, gosh, I thought that was a wonderful summary. I just think that, you know, make the leap. If you're 50% exhilarated and 50% terrified, leap. Because the terror grounds you and the exhilaration keeps you optimistic and buoyant. So that's the other toggling that we got to do in order to continue to be creative.
Fantastic. Very nice. Thank you so much, Natalie. And to our listeners, do check out Natalie's book as well. So we'd urge you to go and find it on Amazon or I'm sure all good booksellers. So The Creativity Leap, Unleash Curiosity, Improvisation and Intuition at Work by Natalie Nixon.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a Curious Advantage podcast. We're curious to hear from you. And if you think there was something useful or valuable from this conversation, we encourage you to write a review for the podcast on your preferred channel, saying why this was so and what you've learned from it. We always appreciate hearing our listeners' thoughts and having a curious conversation. Join today at hashtag Curious Advantage. Curious Advantage book is available on Amazon worldwide. Order your copy now to further explore the 7 C's model for being more curious. Subscribe today and keep exploring curiously. See you next time.
Thank you for listening to the Curious Advantage podcast. The Curious Advantage book is now available to purchase on Amazon. Stay tuned for the next episode and keep exploring curiously. This podcast is produced by Aliki Palinelli and John McGinty and edited by Jill Damatak-Futter.